Anyway, after an introduction by a socialist chairman who says the speaker is now going to deal with some aspect of socialist thought, it would be nice if I could go straight into the talk, but unfortunately this is not the case. It's not yet the case, because there's still so much confusing about what is the exact meaning of the word socialism. So this meeting will be like all our meetings that have to start it by defining exactly what we mean. A short definition of socialism is, if you like, the sort of society described by William Morris in News from Noah, which was published in 1890. I'm not talking about the details of dress or about the details of architecture, or even about the details of the choice of technology, but about the social basis of the society described in that utopian romance, as he called it. First of all, it was a society where the means of production are not monopolized by a minority class, but they are commonly owned. In other words, that they don't belong to anybody, but that people organized collectively have free access to them, to use them to produce goods to satisfy their needs. Clearly, obviously, it follows from this that it's a society where there is production solely and directly for use. In other words, there's no buying and selling, there's no money, and there's no working for wages. Also, it's a society in which there is, to use a couple of phrases which Morris himself often uses, a society where there is a democratic arrangement of affairs or a democratic administration of things. In other words, there's no political machinery, there's no machinery of government, there's no coercive state machine, there's no armed forces, police, courts, or prisons. Now, Morris himself called this communism or pure communism. As far as we're concerned, we don't mind if people call it communism. For historical reasons, we ourselves use the word socialism. So for us, though this wasn't the case of Morris, as I'll mention later on, it wasn't always the case of Morris. For us, socialism and communism mean exactly the same. They're two interchangeable words. And they mean, as I said, to define socialism rather negatively. It's a classless, moneyless, wageless, stateless society. I suppose I ought to also say something about what I'm going to mean by the word utopian. Well, first of all, I'm not using it as a term of abuse. On the contrary, there isn't enough utopian thinking around today. I mean, people accept the present reality as the only possible reality and don't think enough about possible or probable or desirable alternatives. I know that there is a strand in what can very broadly be called Marxism, at least Marxism in inverted commas, which does tend to use the word utopian as a term of abuse. I mean, to call somebody a utopian socialist is to is to insult him and suggest that he isn't really a serious thinker. But of course, we ourselves have been the victims of this. You know, we ourselves have been called, you know, utopian socialists so often that we don't fall into this particular trap ourselves. In any event, this wasn't quite how Marx and Engels, in fact, used this term. You know, when, for instance, in the Communist Manifesto, I talk about people like Robert Owen and others as utopians, this was not because they thought that the sort of society which people like Owen, you know, wanted to achieve, you know, was somehow utopian. Quite the contrary. In fact, they specifically say, if you read the text, that these people had some very interesting ideas to make. For instance, the idea of the disappearance of the distinction between town and country, the idea of abolishing the wages system, the idea that the state machine should be abolished, and its function should become the mere superintendence of production. So that, as I say, the criticism which Marx and Engels made in the Communist Manifesto of people like Owen, Cabet, and the others were not over the end which these people wanted to achieve, even though, of course, they did make a criticism which is to a certain extent valid. These people went sometimes into too much detail, or rather didn't make a distinction between what were the essential features of socialist society and what were the things they would like to see in socialist society. In other words, they went into too much detail. But their criticism, so the criticism of Marx and Engels, of the so-called utopians, was over the means which they proposed to use. As a matter of fact, I'm not going to use the word utopian even exactly in that sense, but it's in its original sense of a writer who describes a future society that does not exist. In other words, a society which, if you like, exists nowhere. And this, of course, is the origin of the word utopia, which was invented by Thomas More in 1516 in his book of that name. Now, this book was written in Latin, and utopia is a Latinized form of a Greek word or two Greek words, meaning no place. Everybody knows, and this is why the Morris's thing was called news from nowhere, news from no place, news from utopia. That's, you know, as far as I'm concerned in this talk, a utopian socialist is a writer about future society, but not any writer about future society, but a writer about future society who sees it as being based on the common ownership. Now, this definition, which I'm prepared to defend, will exclude certain people who've traditionally been regarded as utopian socialists, for instance, both Saint-Simon and Fourier. Although these were people who wrote about future society, and both of them have some very interesting things to say. I mean, it was Saint-Simon who spoke about abolishing petty government, the government of people, and replacing it by industrial administration, the administration of things. And of course, Fourier was one of the first people to say that work could and should be enjoyable. But as far as the definition I've just given is concerned, they weren't utopian socialists. They were utopian writers, because the society which they wanted to see established wasn't, in fact, one that would have been based on the common ownership of the means of production. I'm not going to consider either utopia or utopias as a literary form, because I don't think this was the reason why most utopias were written. Perhaps Thomas More's Utopia was written to entertain and divert, but for instance, books such as Cabet's Voyage to Icaria, Bellamy's Looking Backwards, Morris's News from Nowhere, they were written openly as propaganda for socialism, or at least as propaganda for socialism, as their authors understood it. They were written to encourage people to act, to change the world. In other words, they're political literature, not literary works, and it is on this basis that they must be judged. Briefly, what I'm going to argue in the course of this talk is that the main contribution of the utopian socialist writers was to clarify the idea of socialism on one key point, and that is that the common ownership necessarily meant the disappearance of money and of buying and selling. This wasn't a sort of optional extra, if you like, which the members of socialist society could decide, or we'll keep money or we'll abolish it, maybe we'll abolish it, maybe we won't. But it wasn't, in fact, let's say, an optional extra, but it was an essential defining feature of a communist or a socialist system of society. They also had some interesting things to say about how a moneyless society could function, about how the production and distribution of wealth could take place without buying and selling. It's appropriate, of course, to begin with Moore, since I've said he was the man who quite literally invented the word utopia. I don't want to get into a problem saying that word too often. His book was written right at the beginning of, as I said, in 1516, and the circumstances which surrounded its writing illustrate, in fact, the already international nature of the economy at that time, because capitalism, essentially, if you like, is an international trading economy. Now, Moore was a Tudor government official, and in 1515, he was sent to Flanders, which was then part of the Spanish Empire, on some government business. And in his book, and this is only a literary device, of course, he says that he met in Antwerp a Portuguese explorer who tells him about an island somewhere in the New World, which had just been discovered, not just been discovered, but relatively recently been discovered. He tells him about an island in this part of the world called Utopia. And the first part of Moore's book contains his famous criticism of social conditions in England at that time, of how people were being driven off the land and becoming beggars and thieves and being hung and branded for this, so that the land could be used for raising sheep, because what had happened, the wool production and wool export had become more profitable than subsistence food production. But anyway, eventually, the Portuguese explorer gets around to explaining the economic, social, and political arrangements on the island of Utopia. Now, in one of his many socialist lectures, Morris once declared that he didn't know any better description of a new form of society than that described in Moore's Utopia. And when in, about nearly 10 years later, in 1893, the Cambridge Press, which we've already talked about this morning, earlier this afternoon, brought out an edition of the first English translation of Moore's Utopia. Morris, in his introduction, says that it was a book that was still discussed at branch meetings of working class organisations. Well, it seems to be, or maybe it'll still be true today. Anyway, what were the arrangements in Utopia that interested Morris? Well, you know, why did he find them interesting enough? And I think the best way is to give you a few quotations. As I said, Utopia was written in Latin. It's been translated into English. I shan't quote from the first English translation, otherwise we will get back to whether it was Chaucer or Shakespeare who invented modern English. But the Penguin have brought out a modern translation by Paul Turner, which is quite good, though it's annoying in some parts, because he translates the Latin and Greek words into modern terms. But anyway, this is what we learn about Utopia. First of all, that the system there is based on communal ownership instead of private property. And we're told that the island is divided into 54 districts, which is a town and the surrounding countryside. Anyway, then, so this is what Moore says. The authorities of each town work out very accurately the annual food consumption of their whole area, but they always grow corn and breed livestock far in excess of their own requirements, so that they have plenty to spare for their neighbours. Any necessary equipment which is not available in the country is got from one's hometown. You simply ask an official for what you want, and he hands it over without any sort of payment. And of course, similar arrangements exist in the towns, where production is by artisans rather than farmers. Anyway, every town is divided into four districts of equal size, each with its own shopping centre in the middle of it. There the products of every household are collected in warehouses and then distributed according to type among various shops. When the head of a household needs anything for himself or his family, he just goes to one of these shops and asks for it. Whatever he asks for, he's allowed to take away without any sort of payment, either in money or in kind. After all, why shouldn't he? There's more than enough of everything to go round, so there's no risk of his asking for more than he needs. For why should anyone want to start hoarding when he knows he'll never have to go short of anything? And then Moore also explains, or rather, in fact, it's the Portuguese explorer who explains, under such a system, there's bound to be plenty of everything. And as everything is divided equally among the entire population, there obviously can't be any poor people or beggars. Each town sends three representatives to the annual parliament. There they collect details of the year's production, and as soon as it's clear which products are in plentiful supply in each area and which are in short supply, they arrange for a series of transfers to equalise distribution. These transfers are one-way transfers, requiring nothing in return. But in practice, the free gifts that town A makes to town B are balanced by the free gifts that it receives from town C. So the whole island is one big household. And obviously, in such a system, there's no need for money. Silver and gold, we're told, the raw materials of money get no more respect from anyone than their intrinsic value deserves, which is obviously far less than that of iron. Without iron, human life is simply impossible, just as it is without fire or water. But we could easily do without silver and gold if it weren't for the idiotic concept of scarcity value. And in fact, Moore says that in Utopia, gold is used for chamber pots. Sorry to have to go from discussing art to discussing public lavatories in socialism, but in fact, Lenin is generally credited with this idea, which in fact is a very sensible idea, because gold is particularly resistant to acid corrosion. Lenin said that in socialism we'll use gold to line public lavatories, but in fact, he pinched the idea from Moore. Now, what did Morris find interesting in this? Obviously not the fact that the island was divided into 54 districts, or the towns into four districts, or that the stewards wore funny hats, or that the priests were married, or anything like that. What he was interested in was the social basis and the way in which things were organised. Basically, that there was, first of all, common ownership of the land and instruments of labour. Secondly, that this led to the production of useful things that were needed by the community. And finally, of course, that there was no money, no riches. Now, Moore's book, in fact, was immensely influential. I mean, I say it was written in Latin, which gave it immediately at that time a universal circulation throughout the whole of Europe. I mean, in fact, it was known for centuries afterwards as the book advocating communism. Well, perhaps advocating is too strong. It was the book describing communism, since Moore was, of course, a devout Catholic, and eventually had his head chopped off, by Henry VIII, I was going to say, but that brings us back to William Morris making his own things. Henry VIII ordered that somebody else should cut off Moore's head, and three centuries later, the reactionaries of the Catholic Church decided that he'd worked three miracles, and he's now St. Thomas More. So, I mean, whether a man like that could really have believed in communism must be open to serious doubt. Anyway, but he wrote quite an acceptable and influential description of it. As I said, it was translated into English comparatively early in 1551, and Jack Bradley is our expert on the various editions, English editions, of More's Utopia. But it was known to the radicals in the English Civil War period. In the following century, it was also known to the people in France in the 18th century in the run-up to the French Revolution. Of course, the system of society, or the system of production described in Utopia, reflects the relatively low level of the development of the productive forces at that time. Basically, it's agriculture and handicrafts. But this, of course, was an inevitable feature of communist schemes right up until the 1840s. This can be seen in the one that was suggested the following century in 1652 by Gerard Winstanley in his Law of Freedom in a Platform. Now, strictly speaking, this pamphlet is not a utopian writing, because Winstanley wasn't describing an ideal future society. I mean, but as the title indicates, it's a law of freedom in a platform. This was a platform. It was a political program to be implemented by political action, indeed to be implemented by direct action, because Winstanley was the spokesman for the Diggers, which was the most radical section of the English revolutionary movement, which kicked out the king, and in fact, this time, also beheaded him in 1649, and which made Britain, for a number of years, a republic or commonwealth, to use the term that was then used. Now, the Diggers' basic argument was that political change, in other words, the replacement of what they called kingly government by a free commonwealth, was not enough. and that it should be supplemented by a social change which would abolish private ownership of land and the instruments of production, and it should establish in its place the free use of the earth and its fruits. And the diggers demanded that this should be put into practice for the benefit of the landless poor of the time, on the land which had been confiscated during the Civil War period from the royalists and from the bishops, and of course on existing common land. And in 1649 they took direct action to begin this. If they took over some land at Cobham, southwest of London, they worked it in common with the intention of eventually enjoying the fruits of their collective labour in common, but this wasn't to be because it was stopped by the local landlords and the local magistrates. This failure, and the failure in fact of Cromwell and the other leaders of the parliamentary army to intervene to support the diggers, prompted Winstanley to put their ideas down in writing, hence this Law of Freedom as a pamphlet, which in fact is a sort of, I think you could use the term, a sort of communist manifesto of the time, because it's appealing to the landless poor to end their oppression by the rich through establishing a communistic system of society. As I said, it's not strictly speaking a utopia, but it can't be ignored when you're dealing with pre-19th century contributions to social thought. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that there's nothing to match either in the clarity of his communist ideas or in the way that they expressed for the next 200 years in the English language. In fact, not until the time of William Morris himself. Because the English Civil War, the English Revolution against the King, was a popular revolution. So that the language that was implied in the pamphlets and the tracts of the time was the language that was spoken by the people, and Winstanley was no example in the pamphlets and tracts, because he was also, like everybody else at that time, wrote religious tracts. These were written in the popular language of the time, which is still quite comprehensible to us today. In fact, to go back to the controversy we just had, I think that it's much easier to understand Winstanley than it is, perhaps Steve will confirm this, than it is to understand Shakespeare. And there's a reason for this, though, which might not be appropriate in his case, but was in mine, and that is that it's the same language that's used in the Bible that I had rammed down my throat when I was in school. And just as an aside, of course, trendy Parsons have now changed the language of the Bible into modern English, but this has completely missed the point, because the thing about the Bible wasn't its content, which generally heard about rubbish, but was about the form. And once you change the form and put it into modern English, it really means nothing. I mean, people here might be surprised to hear an atheistic socialist complaining about the Church of England and other churches changing the Bible, but I think it comes back to the point that Jack made, that the language of the Bible was that's English culture, that's the English language which we're part of. Anyway, Winstanley wrote very clearly and very simply. He didn't use any jargon, for the simple reason that there wasn't any, because his book was quite literally the first expression of the case. Well, I've got case for socialism down here, but perhaps somebody will take me up. I'll say the case for a communist system of society written in the English language. In fact, there are excuse me, how many more minutes? I've got to keep going. In fact, there are phrases. It's only 1652, you're right. In fact, there are phrases and terms in Winstanley that we could think seriously about reviving today. For instance, we know what we mean when we say that we stand for common ownership or for socialism, but we share this language with people who stand not for socialism, but for state capitalism. You know, with the result that when we say, for instance, that we stand for common ownership, people think, yes, I know what you mean. You want everything to be nationalised. And, of course, we have to go back to square one. But consider for a moment some of the phrases that Winstanley used to describe his aim. The free use of the earth, the free enjoyment of the earth, the common enjoyment of the earth a common treasury. Now, if you know, we now, today, were to say that we stood for the free use of the earth and its fruits, it wouldn't be misunderstood as advocating nationalisation or state capitalism. And as a matter of fact, we'd be giving a strictly accurate description of socialism, because the earth or nature is the first source of all wealth. In fact, you know what is wealth but nature transformed by human beings for their use and their enjoyment? Of course, we have moved to a certain extent in this direction when we talk about socialism being a world of free access, and free access not only, in fact, not mainly to consumer goods, in other words, the fruits of production, but free access also to the to nature, to land, and to the man-made means of production. Or to follow, you know, Win Stanley again, the earth becomes a common treasury for all. It becomes a common store. I mean, I think that we should revive this sort of terminology precisely in order to mark us off from the advocates of state capitalism. Anyway, let's get back to Win Stanley. As I said, he was a Christian, and one of the, I suppose, quaint things about his book is that you come across passages where he quotes the Old Testament and the Book of Revelations and so on to justify communism. I have to say, I wish I knew these things when I was in school. I could have used it against the religious ignorance teacher. But anyway, he was a Christian, and one of his arguments was that God had given the earth to all mankind without distinction, to use and to enjoy. That we talked about the free use of the earth being a creation right or a creation freedom. But he also justified this on strictly materialist grounds by arguing that the denial of this right meant that those who were excluded from exercising it were dependent on those who did, and it was no more right that a minority should monopolize the earth, in words, the means of life, or any means of life, than that a minority should, you know, monopolize the air we breathe or the water we drink, which are also equally important or equally essential to life. In other words, he was fully aware that the private ownership of the earth and its fruits meant the division of society into classes, two classes, two antagonistic classes, in the sense that the one of them lived by exploiting and oppressing the other. And this was why Win Stanley and the diggers addressed their appeal precisely to the propertyless, the landless class of their time. Now, Win Stanley begins, which is in fact quite logical for a treatise on freedom, by asking, you know, what is freedom? And he says, freedom is not freedom of trade. Freedom is not freedom of conscience or anything like that, but freedom is the free use of the earth, since it is from the earth that man lives. And this, in fact, is what he writes, and you can see whether you agree with me or not, whether you can still understand his language today. True freedom lies where a man receives his nourishment and preservation, and that is in the use of the earth. A man had better to have no body than to have no food for it. Therefore, this restraining of the earth from brethren by brethren is oppression and bondage, but the free enjoyment thereof is true freedom. In other words, freedom is a very materialist thing. It's a bread and butter issue, and it's not an extraction, an abstraction. Of course, that is exactly the definition. We don't like words like freedom, but I mean, if you force us to give a definition of freedom, that's the definition that you would get. Now, Win Stanley held that mankind had originally lived under conditions of freedom. In other words, that at one time all humans had once had free access to the earth and its fruits on an equal basis. And his theory of how this came to be undermined is interesting, not only for the development of his argument, but also because, to a certain extent, it has been confirmed by later ethnological and social research. I mean, he argued that the first step away from this condition was the introduction of buying and selling, which broke up the original community of interest and introduced conflict. And the need was then felt for an institution to enforce law and order, I mean, what we would call the state, but which he calls kingly government. But in this way, Win Stanley was able to establish a direct link between kingly government and buying and selling. So he's able to say to Cromwell and the others, that it wasn't sufficient just to end kingly government, but that the free use of the earth had to be restored as well. I mean, if you like, just as kingly government went with buying and selling, so a free commonwealth logically should go with the abolition of buying and selling. So, for instance, he says that commonwealth government governs the earth without buying and selling. There should be no buying and selling of the earth, nor of the fruits thereof. There should be no buying and selling in a free commonwealth, neither shall anyone hire his brother to work for him. You might ask, in fact, how do you think things would be organized, or could be organized, without buying and selling? I'd like to read two or three passages from Wynne Stanley to show the extent to which he appreciated the full implications of what he was saying. Anyway, the earth is to be planted and the fruits reaped and carried into barns and storehouses by the assistance of every family. And if any man or family want corn or other provision, they may go to the storehouses and fetch without money. If they want a horse to ride, go to the fields in summer or to the common stables in winter and receive one from the keepers. And when your journey is performed, bring him where you had him without money. If any want food or victuals, they may either go to the butcher shops and receive what they want without money, and here's the part I don't like, or else go to the flocks of sheep or herds of cattle and take and kill what meat is needful for their families without buying and selling. And the reason why all the riches of the earth are a common stock is this, because the earth and the labours thereon are managed by common assistance of every family without buying and selling. Once again, as with Moore, it's the same situation in the towns. Every tradesman shall fetch materials as leather, wool, flax, corn, and the like from the public storehouses to work upon without buying and selling. And when particular works are made, as cloth, shoes, hats, and the like, the tradesman shall bring these particular works to particular shops, as is now in practice, without buying and selling. And every family, as they want such things as they cannot make, they shall go to these shops and fetch without money, even as they now fetch with money. Once again, there is free access according to need. There shall be storehouses in all places, both in the country and in cities, to which all the fruits of the earth and other works made by tradesmen shall be bought, and from thence delivered out again to particular families, and to everyone as they want for their use. And as everyone works to advance the common stock, so everyone shall have a free use of any commodity in the storehouse for his pleasure and comfortable livelihood, without buying and selling or restraint from any. I mean, this, if you like, is a plan for a society of free access, or even for self-regulating production for use in the conditions of the 17th century. I mean, I can't fault it, I don't think, as a description of how moneyless society could have operated at that time. And I think, what Morris was quoted earlier, what Morris had said about Moore's utopia, that he didn't know of any better description of the new form of society than that described in Moore's utopia, could also be said with even more force, to the extent it's true, of Wynne Stanley. Now, in theory, Morris could himself have said this about Wynne Stanley himself, but in fact, he wasn't aware of Wynne Stanley's writings, because they were only discovered, or rediscovered, remained virtually unknown until 1894, the 1890s. And incidentally, as an anecdote, one of the people that did uncover Wynne Stanley's writings was the same Edward Bernstein that we like to denounce as the originator of revisionism and reformism. In his book, Cromwell and Communism, at that time he was still a socialist, mind you, but in his book, Cromwell and Communism, once again, it took somebody from outside the country to discover what had been forgotten. So I'm saying, in my opinion, Wynne Stanley's Law of Freedom is still very good, I'm prepared to use the word, very good socialist propaganda. I mean, every socialist, in my opinion, should have a copy of it, should be aware of it, or should be prepared to lend it to other people and encourage other people to read it, because it's better than Moore's in the sense that Wynne Stanley has a class approach. It's an appeal to the populous poor of the time to end the privileges of the rich, as I said before, by establishing communism. Now, the same phenomena of the emergence of communist ideas amongst a small minority of bourgeois revolution, or small minority of revolutionaries occurred in the French Revolution itself. And these were the people who argued, once again, just like the diggers did, that it wasn't sufficient to establish a republic and to abolish royal and aristocratic privileges, but that liberty, equality, fraternity, or in fact, particularly equality, could only be established by the abolition of private property and the establishment of a moneyless communist society. This was the position that was taken up of those involved in the so-called conspiracy of the equals in 1796, associated with the name of Babeuf, who was in fact guillotined for his part in this plot. Now, a manifesto of the equals was drawn up at the time, but wasn't in fact published because they couldn't agree on the exact text. In fact, the man that drafted it was an atheist, but the others weren't prepared. They were prepared to say we must hang up priests and things like and execute all the kings and nobles, but they weren't prepared to come out as open atheists. But anyway, but the text was published later on in 1828 by one of the participants, whose book, called Filippo Buonarroti, his book on the conspiracy of the equals, had an immense influence of the revival of communist ideas that was to take place throughout Europe in the 1830s and 1840s. Now, when communist ideas did revive in Europe in the 1840s, the most successful propagandist for communism in France, in fact, in the whole of Europe, and when I say successful in terms of his audience, in terms of his meetings and sales of his pamphlets and so on, was Etienne Cabet, who is the author of a utopian novel, Voyage to Icaria. It's rather odd that Engels, in his book Socialism, Utopian and Scientific, should just pass over Cabet in a footnote. I should concentrate on Saint-Simon and Fourier, who weren't, as I said, they were utopians, but they weren't socialists. But anyway, Cabet had been a democratic politician, but had been sentenced to 5 years exile for subversion, which he spent in England, where, according to him, he became a communist once again by reading Moore's Utopia. And he decided to write his own utopian novel, once again consciously, as a means for propagating communist ideas. And in fact, like Utopia, Icaria is an island somewhere in the southern hemisphere. Now, Cabet's book was published in 1840, first of all, anonymously, and then from 1842 under his own name. Now, in Icaria, all land and industry belongs to the community and is organized as a single enterprise, producing according to what has been previously decided by various democratic means, should be produced. It's the first communist utopia to incorporate industrial and factory production. In fact, there's no buying and selling, and there's obviously no money either. In fact, when the hero, for some reason, is an English lord, when it's been explained to him that it's based on common ownership, that somebody says, well, now you understand why we haven't got any beggars or servants here. Somebody else said, well, you understand when you were travelling from the coast to here, you didn't have to pay for your transport, you didn't have to pay for the food you had, you didn't have to pay for your lodgings, and finally the book said, look, we don't need any money here in Icaria because we get things supplied to us free. And in fact, Cabet was probably the originator of the phrase, from each according to their abilities, to each according to their needs, though he didn't in fact give it the same interpretation that we do, because William Morris interpreted this as meaning that needs should be decided by the individual, but Cabet meant that they should be decided democratically by decision of the whole community. And communist ideas were also circulating in England at this time, particularly amongst the Chartist movement, or at least the radical wing of the Chartist movement. Robert Owen was a communist, even though he rejected the class struggle, but there are other people who were influenced both by Owen's communistic ideas and by their experience of the class struggle. Let's just stop here for a moment, because we've reached the 1840s. Otherwise, we've reached a time before Marx and Engels have become socialist or communist, but it's clear that there's already in existence a long tradition and an existing movement which had realized, first of all, that the only way to end oppression and exploitation of populist classes in society was to abolish private property and to establish the common ownership of land and industry. That secondly, that this would involve production for use. In other words, that the production and distribution of wealth should be consciously organized and regulated to produce what people needed. And thirdly, that in such a society there'd be no money, no buying and selling, but that the fruits of production would be distributed freely to people, or would be made freely available for them to take. So that when Marx in 1843 and Engels in 1842 became communists, they were joining an already existing movement with clear ideas, already clear ideas on the necessarily moneyless nature of communist society, and with a basic idea of how such a society could function. I mean, what they did was to help clarify the ideas of the movement they joined on the issue of the question of materialism, on the class struggle, on economics. But all these elements were already there, and if it hadn't been Marx, it would have been someone else. This is why, at least to my way of thinking, the term Marxism is a bit of an absurdity. I mean, I know we use it from time to time, but I mean, all we mean by it, in fact, what we can mean by it, is that we use the same language, the same concepts, and the same arguments as Marx. And of course, Marx did make an immense contribution here, but it wasn't, to get back to this other thing, it wasn't the contribution of a genius. I mean, this would have come up before. But one thing that Marx didn't have to clarify the ideas of the movement which he joined on was, as I say, on the nature of the sort of society which was needed to take the place of capitalism. Now, it's sometimes forgotten that Morris was a contemporary of Marx and Engels. I mean, he was born in... Morris was born in 1834, Marx in 1818, and Engels in 1820, which, I mean, that's the difference between the age of me and the chairman, I mean, or between me and Eddie.
In whichever direction.
But, I mean, it isn't a major difference in age, and in fact... Morris died the year after Engels, but because Morris didn't become a socialist until he was nearly 50, 1883, while Marx and Engels had become socialists in their 20s, he is, and he appears to be, more of, if you like, a second-generation Marxist, of course, in inverted commas. But, I mean, he did, in fact, quite frequently meet Engels in the 1880s, but he never met Marx, though he was involved in politics during Marx's life, because as was explained this afternoon, that Morris's whole life was in fact a revolt or rejection against the commercial values of capitalism. But he didn't in fact become involved in politics in the narrow sense until 1876, when he became active, became the treasurer of the Eastern Question Association. Now, the Eastern Question was an obsession with Marx. I mean, he believed that he seemed to really convince himself that there was a plot by the Tsar to try to take over the whole world and rule the whole world. I mean, these writings in which Marx says this aren't generally published because they're rather embarrassing to Russia and also rather embarrassing to us as well. I mean, anyway, in the Eastern Question Association, Morris and Marx did in fact take up opposite positions. You know, Morris was taking up, if you like, an anti-Turk position because of the so-called Bulgarian atrocities, whereas Marx was saying, we must be against the Turks before the Russians. We must, in fact, have war with Russia. And at the time, he was, Morris was collecting money for the Eastern Question Association, which was a sort of wishy-washy liberal CND type thing, while Marx was writing anonymous articles in the Daily Telegraph accusing Gladstone of having sold out to the Tsar. So that if you had to choose between the two, I would think that the least objectionable position would have been that of Morris. But even then, Morris wasn't yet a socialist. Now, I could go on to say a bit more about Morris, but I think this has already been said this afternoon, and will be said tomorrow. But I just want to make the point that Morris was a socialist in the same sense that we are, because he had the same basic argument as I quoted from Win Stanley, that as long as the means of production, reintroducing wealth, monopolized by a section only of society is going to be divided into two antagonistic classes. One of them is going to be living off the other by exploiting it. And Morris called this, or described the situation as being monopoly, which of course is in fact a term which occurs in our own Declaration of Principles. And he argued that this was the basic cause of working class problems, this was the basic cause, in fact, of social problems in society generally, and that there could be no lasting improvement made to conditions, certainly not to conditions of the wage and salary earners, as long as this continued. And of course, the opposite of monopoly, as far as he was concerned, was freedom. And in fact, there's in this month's Socialist Standard, there's a photo of one of his pamphlets, which I think says all about Morris' position. It's called, you know, Monopoly, or How Labour is Robbed. And the solution, as I said, was freedom, which he says, socialists assert that everyone should have free access to the means of wealth, the raw material and stored up force produced by labour. In other words, the land, plant and stock of the community, which are now monopolised by certain privileged persons who force others to pay for their use. In fact, Morris believed in the literal and full and conscious application of the principle, from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. And in fact, he says in one of his talks that this was why he became a communist in the first place. He didn't see what he thought people's needs, both as producers and as consumers, should be met on an equal basis. And he realized that as long as in a society where you had private ownership or private property in the means of production, this wouldn't be possible. And in fact, from 1887, by 1887 onwards, he liberally started calling himself a communist rather than simply a socialist, in order to distinguish himself from people who said that the principle that will apply in socialism will be not from each according to their ability to each according to their needs, but from each according to their ability to each according to their deeds or to each according to their services. Though, to tell the truth, Morris, like Marx, did think that society would have to pass through such a stage, which of course implied continuing to link individual consumption to individual work effort, making calculating pay and prices and so on, even if this had to be done in labour time vouchers rather than money. But he felt this period would be passed through fairly quickly, in fact much more quickly than Marx himself did. Of course, in what we would say today, is that this is more or less an academic question, because, I mean, for instance, in News from Nowhere, you read about people travelling around in whatever they are, horse and carriages or horse and carts. Well, partly because Morris didn't like the railways, but, I mean, that was, in between railway stations, that was the only means of transport in the 1890s. So, I mean, the development of the means of production, or the forces of production, since the 1890s has been so tremendous. All this talk about passing through transition periods and lower stages and socialism and communism and so on and so forth has been bypassed. But just to sum up, of course, as I said before, right at the beginning, as far as we're concerned, socialism and communism mean the same thing. But we have to admit that, in fact, this wasn't always the case in Morris. Morris did make a distinction between socialism, which was basically what Marx's so-called lower stage of communism before you could have full free access to the means of production, and communism, which was the higher stage, where we'd apply from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs. Now, this has been latched onto by most of the people who've written about Morris, and it shouldn't be forgotten that even E.P. Thompson, at the time he wrote his book, which had been referred to already, was a card-carrying Stalinist. And all the others, Page Arnott, A.L. Morton, Jack Lindsay, Paul Meyer, all these people were or are members of the Communist Party, and they've tried to paint Morris as some sort of proto-Lenin, or maybe, but of course this is absurd. If you look at the system of society which exists in Russia, you can see also that it's based on monopoly. There is a minority that controls access to the means of production and which lives off the backs of the workers. So it's quite absurd that these people should claim Morris as a supporter of Russian state capitalism.